You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. In this episode, I sit down with singer-songwriter Amy Mann. The Grammy winner and self-described Oscar loser, who was recently named to NPR's list of the 10 finest living songwriters. While Amy is widely acknowledged for her songwriting talent, her lesser-known role as an industry trailblazer is as laudable as it is fascinating. Starting with the sudden and disconcerting fame of her band Tell Tuesday, and spanning 8 solo albums, the arc of her career has largely reflected, and in some ways shaped, the music business itself. Much of that career was defined by her struggle, and just plain bad luck, with record labels that couldn't see past Amy's model looks and the dollar signs in their eyes that she was not the artist they were molding her to be. In her struggle to stay true to herself as an artist, Mann chafed under contracts, and finally started her own label in order to put out her finely observed songs the way she wanted to put them out. A groundbreaking move at the time, and one that paved the way for musicians just starting to navigate the chaos of the music business today. The irony? With no more Goliath labels to fight, and at the absolute peak of her talent as a songwriter, the channels for distributing and making a living from music are disappearing. With surprising humor and optimism, Amy lets us in on her bumpy journey, tells us about a few surprising hobbies, and why, after a career-long struggle to make a living with her art, she believes there's always a next step. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Okay. So, Amy, thank you for doing this and for sitting down with me. I appreciate it. I met you a long time ago, and I've followed your career, and I was just kind of going back over it, and I realized, like, you've made 8 solo records?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, that's quite a career.
I feel like I feel like I've hit a number where I can feel, like, pretty satisfied. Like, yeah, that's an achievement.
It's a canon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
A canon. You just got me to agree that I have a canon.
So I've been listening to Charmer, which is your latest record, and it reminded me of, you know, you really have this ability of kind of picking up on little details that reveal character flaws and reveal character in people. And I just wonder, like, you know, when you were young, was that something you were conscious of?
Or? No, I mean, I think it's funny you say that because I feel like I'm a terrible observer. I'm one of those people who I can't, if I remember a conversation, I don't remember who I had it with or who else was there or where we were. Like, I can only remember one detail, like, wait a minute, didn't we have dinner at that restaurant? But who was there or where, like, what? I don't remember anything. So I think it's, I mean, obviously if I'm including details in a song that I got them from somewhere, but
right.
I don't know, it's probably not real life.
I think that what I was driving at was the people feel very real in your songs. They feel like people you know intimately, and whether or not they're autobiographical or not.
I usually do start with a person I know, and then it becomes a composite, and then that composite kind of becomes a fictional version or a fictional character. But I usually do start with people I know. I think that the realism, I mean, for me, comes from I'm better at getting, I mean, like, I'm not good at sort of observing or remembering details or, like, what people said or what they were wearing or that kind of thing, but I get there's, like, an internal thing that I get that I can't really put into words, but when then I connect it with music, the music, for some reason, helps me find language for it, and I don't really understand how that works. I kind of have this theory that the music is so sort of right brain that it activates like that emotional right brain stuff and then frees up the left brain to kind of bring language into it. I don't know, that's a vague theory that I haven't really thought out very much.
Well, I mean, so you mean if you sat down at a typewriter So yeah. As a novelist, you wouldn't be
absolutely.
As...
No, absolutely. Yeah, I can barely write a cogent email. It's really hard for me to, I don't know how people do that. Like, just fine. I think that's like why I'm so fascinated with comedians, that because they always have like the perfect right word that, you know, that like has that impact. And I'm like, how did you come up with that word? Especially on the spot. Like, how did you improvise that, those series of word usements that...
But it's funny. It's like a comedian would look at you and go, well, how did you know to go there on the chorus? And, you know, I think that we take for granted the things that we do every day, right?
Yeah.
To where we have this set of tools. We don't even know they're tools, but... You know, like as a songwriter, you know kind of what works and what doesn't. You can very quickly probably say, oh, I've gone there before, or...
Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe that's the same thing with a comedian, where, they, you know, they've tried this kind of material, this...
Yeah, this. I mean, I think, I'm sure there's a giant component, like everything, where if you do it a million times, eventually your brain becomes accustomed to making finer and finer distinctions and kind of knowing there's types of places that you can go. I mean, I see that just knowing, you know, all the comedians I know and seeing them at work. Like you kind of see it, but still, it still seems like kind of a magic to me, where people can just talk and like it makes sense and they're, you know, poetic and inspiring and funny and articulate.
But that to me is the greatest thing about the fact that you could, as an artist, you can express yourself in so many different ways, because here you are, you're a songwriter and you are fascinated and amazed by what a comedian can do. Mm-hmm. And maybe a comedian is fascinated that someone could write a dramatic script or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there are all these pursuits I've listened to your music and followed your career and some of the twists and turns that you can make in a song are just completely something I could never do or come up with, or not only lyrically, but musically, you know? And you maybe take that for granted.
I do. I think I do. I know, I do. I think I feel like anyone could do it. Yeah. Or, you know, if I taught you some basic music theory, you know, so you kind of more or less know how certain chords want to go to the other chords, and you try those chords out, and you can figure it out.
A lot of people know music theory. but isn't that the thing? Like, it's like the comedian that can string the exact right words together, and then
I don't know any comedians who would say anyone can do it.
No kidding. That's interesting.
Yeah. I would guarantee you that all the comics I know would say, no, anybody can't do it. Like, they're very offended at that very idea.
Right. You know, in the craft of songwriting, I think there are two very distinct approaches that I can think of. There's the Brill Building, build your craft, you know, the Elvis Costello, Burt Bacharach, you know, and then there's kind of these conduit people like Neil Young or whatever, that just maybe a song comes to them and they have to get it before it. Are both of those valid for you?
Yeah. I mean, when you get that sort of like, just sit down and write a song and like, wow, that's, there it is. That's amazing, but that's super rare. I mean, I would obviously like that's more fun. It's obviously more fun because it's less work. And also like you get that, you know, the thrill of feeling like that it's almost kind of magic or something. But that happens so rarely.
Yeah.
I don't, you know.
Is there a song that it's happened on that just jumps right to your mind for you?
No, I mean, a song I wrote pretty recently. I was trying to think of, you know, songs on this record. I think they were all pretty crafty, you know, pretty, you know, this is worked on. I mean, parts of them come and then you got to get to work and finish it. Like, you know, you got to get to work and like, well, it needs a bridge. That bridge is not going to write itself.
Now, is songwriting for you, is it a craft, like, or does it come fraught with a lot of, you know, is it a self examining emotional thing that's fraught with, you know, pitfalls and everything? Or do you enjoy the process?
I do. I mean, it's not entirely bloodless, but it is. I mean, I enjoy the process of working on it too. You know, like there's, I like knowing that I have resources that will help me get to the point where I'm going to come up, you know, I'm going to have a line that's really satisfying, that says what I wanted to say, that says it in an interesting way, that is going to be a perfect rhyme with the next line, that might have some internal rhymes and some internal meter stuff that makes it interesting. You know, to know that putting work into it will get me to that point is very satisfying. And it hasn't always, you know, I mean, that develops over time. In earlier days of songwriting, it was kind of like putting a lot of work into it was, you know, at some point it was going to be diminishing returns, and it just wasn't going to, you know, like I have to go like, this is not going to get any better. You know, this is what it is.
That was what in the past, but
yeah,
now you feel like you've crossed that barrier.
Yeah. I think I've just gotten better. You know, I've gotten better. I know how to work. I think my standards have gone up, and I think that's like a big thing too about any art, is that if you have high standards and then you keep matching, you know, what you're doing against your standards, then, you know, you keep at it. If your standards are low, you know, you're gonna stop pretty early on in the process.
Does it ever frustrate you that there's maybe less interest as an artist gets older and watching them, because maybe they know too much, or maybe they've been around too long?
Yeah, I mean, obviously because I'm getting older, I mean, obviously I've thought about this. I definitely think I'm a much better songwriter in terms of, you know, like what everything that's important to me about songwriting, including, you know, being emotionally connected to the material and having an energy and an urgency in it, as well as just the, you know, being a better craftsman. You know, when you're younger, you don't always know how to really connect to your emotional world. I mean, when you're younger, a lot of your, you know, like a lot of art or music or whatever is more about just trying to look like you're an artist, you know what I mean? Like trying to look like you're a certain thing, or trying to just fit in. And I think some older artists kind of don't care about that as much. And that's liberating and feels more like what true art should be about, you know? I mean, when I first started writing songs, all I wanted to do was write a song that sounded like another song, so that it sounded like a, you know what I mean? So,
right.
You know, it's, yeah, you're like, just make this be a song that sounds like a legitimate thing, not necessarily a song that expresses anything I'm actually thinking or feeling. Here's what I'm mostly thinking or feeling in my early 20s. I hope I fit in. I mean, and that's not that interesting, you know, like,
right.
I hope I fit in, and I hope people don't think I'm a fraud, or I hope, you know, I want to be liked. You know, like that seems kind of anti-art, really, to have. I mean, but, you know, that's what, like, being young is mostly about.
Yeah.
Just wanting to be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody who cares less about wanting to be cool, I think, is more interesting.
Do you think your early records would stand up to someone's interest in their, you know, at our age now, can you listen to that record and find meaning in it, or can you listen to that record and it's part of its own time?
I think it's more part of its own time. I mean, you know, I like my older records, but you know, I don't think, I mean, I just don't think I was as good. You know, I think there's a lot of songs I would go, eh, that's okay. That had some moments. You know, that had a couple of good lines. It would be improved by just better, I don't know, you know. I mean, there would be a lot of things I would change.
Have you learned how to, be kinder to yourself in the writing and revising and editing process?
I'm pretty good about not thinking about an audience response or like a particular person's response. But that, you know, I mean, I've definitely had some problems with that, you know, in the past, kind of like, it's hard to be totally impervious to it. I remember sort of being on certain record labels and like, you know, when you hear the constant refrain of like, we don't hear a single, then you do sort of like everything you are working on, it's hard to like banish the thought of like, okay, they're not going to think this is, you know, like you just do start to anticipate what the reaction is going to be, and then you're pre-discouraged. I mean, it's hard to keep working on like the, you know, the melancholy country waltz that you know nobody's going to, you know, like, why finish writing this? Because apparently everything I do is a piece of shit. You know, like it's, I think like that at times has been hard to get past when the only response, you know, I got from my music was from record company people. But I'm not like a real terrible critic of myself. Like I'm okay about just sort of seeing something through and yeah, I mean, I don't think I have like an inordinate amount of self-loathing, like, you can't, you know, you don't know what you're doing. If I'm not enjoying something, I just put it aside and pick up a different song.
Right.
You know, because it's fun. I mean, I do, like, writing's fun. It's thrilling. And I don't like hammer it, you know, to the point where it's frustrating. And, you know, and I don't think I have unrealistic expectations. You know, like I know when I've reached the point of like, I'm laboring over it now, and I say just let it go. You know, it is what it is at this point.
That's interesting you say that, because I just read a quote that Hemingway said, always stop when you're going good.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Like resist the urge to keep going until you've totally burned the candle out, because you'll be able to start better the next time you pick it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does a song have to be started and finished for you, like in a time block, or how does that work for you?
It really varies. I mean, look, there's the rare song that gets written in a day, that's not the usual. Generally, I feel lucky if I have a verse and a chorus, and then I feel like, okay, I got it, you know, and then the rest is just work. You know, I'm working on it. Like, okay, what do I want the next verse to say? What kind of bridge should it have? And then that's like a little more difficult because it's sort of like a third, you know, like a whole different musical thing to come up with. But if I have the verse and the chorus, I feel like the template is set and I'm on pretty firm ground, and then I, you know, just have to put the work in.
Do you write continuously, or do you say, okay, I have to write a record now, or I want to write a record now?
That's what I did for this one, and then I realized I did not like that experience. So as soon as this record came out, I said, I'm going to do something which I've never done before, which is sit down every day and do some writing, even if it's just 15 minutes, and that's been really fun. Like I actually have like half of the next record written already. Because it's not that I can't sit down and write the record. It just, it's nice to feel like you have, you're thinking in advance a little bit and not going like, oh, all right, I need to put out a record. Like, oh, what am I going to do? I need an idea, you know.
Have you been able to stick to that?
Yeah, I sort of had a goal. Like I started this summer because I had time off this summer. And, you know, it was like at the end of the summer, I want to have 6 songs, you know, and I'm like, because I clearly don't write super fast, you know. I keep a song in my head, and I mean, I might have most of it, but then there's like that, you know, the third verse or the outro or, you know, whatever. Like, to me, it really has to be like pretty written before I go into the studio and before I start working with other musicians. I'm not like a jam and in the studio, like, let's jam and see what happens. Like, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't work for me. So, I really need it to be written. And, like six songs, you know, in the period of a summer, that's pretty good for me.
Yeah. You know, I wondered if you left some rough edges to see what would happen in the studio, right? Or I also know you play multiple instruments, and do you find yourself pretty autonomous and knowing what you want about arrangements?
I just choose great musicians. I'll usually have a general idea of what I want it to sound like. And I have great players that come up with really interesting parts and interesting sounds on their own. I like to have the experience of having a band sound gel in the studio. We rehearse a little bit before we go into the studio, so everybody's pretty familiar. You know, they're already starting to write parts.
How do those musicians hear the material originally? Is it just acoustic guitar and voice?
Yes, I just send like a little voice memo.
Okay.
Demo.
So it's not like you're not doing a little Pro Tools at home thing and laying
that's not my thing.
Drum track down.
Yeah, that's not my thing. Right. I probably should learn how to do that, but it's too much of a learning curve.
I don't know. I think it's great, you know, to just be able to do that and play with the caliber of people you play with and let them hear it. And it seems like more accidents can happen that way.
And honestly, like sometimes what I need to do, and I hesitate to do this because I think it's like kind of obnoxious for some people, for some musicians, but I sort of need to like have a song as a template and say like, I want it to sound, you know, like the way this guy is playing drums, or like this kind of drum sound, or this vibe, or this, you know, slide guitar or whatever, you know. I sort of need to be like point to other people's music. And I think I sort of feel like musicians don't like that. That's, I don't know, like I've gotten the feeling that maybe that's verboten, that you're
it's
supposed to just,
or something.
Yeah, just like, they should let their freak flag fly, or, you know, but I'm not somebody who can, I can't really articulate what I want more, like I do have, you know, like I can't go in there and say, okay, I want like an eighth note pattern on the hi-hat, but on the kick drum, I need you to do like the and of the three, you know, like
right.
I have to get like, just play what this guy's playing.
I get that.
Yeah.
I mean, as a photographer, sometimes you do see the way something's lit or something is a color palette, and you don't want to have to like say it all. You just want to tear that thing out or show it on the computer and say, let's light it like this.
Yeah.
And then we'll go from there. It'll still be mine, but this is my reference.
Yeah, yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's important to identify.
And
that.
It always is different. It always comes out different, you know.
I have a theory that even if you try to imitate something, you can't.
And to go one step further, I think the more interesting people are the people who try to imitate something but do it very poorly and then come out accidentally with their own thing.
Their own sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny sometimes to hear an artist and you say, oh, they sound like the Grateful Dead or something. And then they're horrified that you told them they sound like that because they were trying to sound like The Clash.
Yeah, oh, that's so funny.
You know.
Or people like, I was talking to Carl Newman, A.C. Newman, and who just put out a record too. And we were both sort of making records at the same time. And I said one of the things that I had started listening to as like an inspiration for this record was, because I was listening to like a lot of 70s pop music, was Jerry Rafferty. So he started listening to Jerry Rafferty, and then he sent me his record and said, yeah, like after we talked, I was doing nothing but listening to Jerry Rafferty, so this record is really influenced by Jerry Rafferty. And then you listen to it, you're like, I don't hear that at all, but hats off. Like, and, you know, like clearly it took him to some place. Like, it doesn't sound at all like Jerry Rafferty, but God bless him.
When you were young, did you, like, looking back now, were there some traits you had or anything that now you can look back and go, oh, yeah, of course I became a songwriter. As a kid, I used to do this or
Mm-mm.
nothing.
No, I can't believe that I'm doing what I'm doing. I mean, not that there was anything else I thought I would be better suited at, but, I was just, super, super quiet and withdrawn and could not interact with people and very, you know, I mean, I think I was like pretty disturbed as a kid. And you know, then I do anything that has, that interfaces with the public or a crowd at all or other people in any way makes me laugh.
Like you were supposed to be an IT person in a
at best,
dark
I
room.
Guess. yeah. Like I guess. And I wasn't like particularly musically. I mean, there was some music I liked. You know, there were a few things that I liked a lot. I was not a big music person. I wasn't like a pretend to play guitar. You know, using a tennis racket in front of the mirror person or like hairbrush. You know, microphone. I didn't, like, I had no sort of dreams of being a rock star. I didn't follow rock bands. Like, even bands I liked, I didn't sort of, you know, like, when I was a little kid listening to Sgt. Pepper, I thought the band was Sgt. Pepper. Like, that's how little I knew about anything that was happening. So I had none of that. I wasn't a person who could figure, you know what I mean? Like, my husband was like, yeah, like, I used to play Beatles songs. I'm like, how... You're figuring out Beatles songs on your own? Like, that's crazy. I can't imagine being that person. And, you know, like, I learned how to play a couple of songs from song books that had, like, the chart of where to put your fingers on the guitar. And I mean, I think it's crazy that I mean, like, you know, like there just one thing led to another, and I don't understand that. I don't understand how that happened. It seems like wildly illogical.
But you know, you say you had kind of you were withdrawn and, you know, had a very, very, I mean, I know that you were raised by your dad mostly, right?
Yeah, and that stepmother.
Tell me that story. Tell me in what ways, like, was there something that made you withdrawn? Because I do think that, I mean, you certainly talk to a lot of artists and you find out there was definitely some trauma or some difficulty in childhood.
Well, my mother left when I was 3, and then my father remarried. And so I didn't, like, know my real mother. I had a brother who was 2 years older. And then, so my father remarried, and she had a couple of kids, and... So they were in our lives till I was like 14, and then they divorced. So there was just like a lot of, you know, people kind of coming and going, and a lot of chaos and that kind of thing. So I was, you know, so I was like just really withdrawn and you know, like, I mean, like dissociated, really, you know. I
was
just
there
wasn't present, you know.
You just kept to yourself, or?
Yeah. But also, I mean, I think I, you know, and there was like other stuff that happened, but I think like I was kind of PTSD, like, honestly. So I think I was like very sort of just dissociated and didn't, you know, like very disconnected from people.
Who were you closest to in your family?
Nobody.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, nobody.
So how did it turn out that you ended up, because you went to school for music a little bit.
Yeah.
How did that?
Well, I was kind of vague, you know, I mean, I was sort of interested in music. Like I, you know, had an acoustic guitar and was trying to write songs, like these terrible songs. And, but I mean, I was also kind of interested in art and, you know, kind of interested in some, you know, I mean, I was interested in arty stuff, but like who isn't, you know, when you're 16?
Well, I think that one thing being withdrawn helps with is it gives you a lot of time to get into art if you're not social.
Yeah.
I think in some ways
it's a thing to interact with, you know. I mean, I think, and also like having, you know, playing music and singing songs like even to yourself is a kind of a way to speak, you know. Like I do think that was probably part of it on some deep level. So, you know, like I was 18 and I'm like had zero idea what to do with myself. And I like heard about this music school that you didn't have to audition for. And it was like, I like music. Like my thinking was maybe if I learn about music, I will know if I have any talent or not. Like maybe that's a thing.
Right.
And I didn't really know how it worked. I mean, I kind of thought that music was just a, you know, like comedy, was just kind of like a magical thing that you either could do or you couldn't. But I wasn't totally sure. And I was a big believer in learning stuff. And I really got that from my father. Like, he was a big believer in just learning about things or how to do things and doing things. And there was this school was called the Berklee College of Music, and they had a 7-week summer session, which you could just, you know, come one, come all. And so I did this summer session and just worked like crazy and kind of discovered that there were aspects of music that if you just practiced, you got better at. You know, not just mechanically. I wanted to learn how to play the bass, so that was my instrument. But you know, things like ear training. You know, listening to a melody and repeating it back, and you know, or chords, and you know, trying to discern what the chord progression is. Something I still can't do. But you just got better at it. And I really was like, I can't believe this. Like, so if I work hard, your talent like goes up. Like, I don't know, like that was really, it was kind of like a miraculous lesson. And I worked really hard. I like practiced like 4 hours a day. You know, I just really, really worked hard. And I, you know, kind of, you know, when I started as like this absolute beginner, but kind of progressed through levels and went, you know, a few semesters and then kind of got into the local music scene in Boston,
right,
and started playing in bands and stuff. And, you know, it was just like one thing. There was always a thing, you know, there was always like a next move. And what I'd said to myself was, you know, I was very cognizant of not wanting to waste my father's money on, you know, chasing some, I mean, it wasn't even a dream. Like, I never was that person. So, you know, I said, well, I'll keep going as long as there's like a next move. And at the point where there's not a next move, I'll go, you know, I'll accept it and then see what the next what possibility is. And there was just always a next move, you know?
In hearing that, you know, that, I wonder if also getting into kind of a social music scene, I guess, you know, being at a college of music, there are a lot of people trying to form bands, find themselves. Did that kind of force you to be more social, or did it get you involved with other people?
I mean, I met some other people. You know, Berklee at that point was still a jazz school, and I was kind of doing, you know, like punky new wave stuff. And which is great because, you know, if you weren't accomplished, if you didn't know how to play really, like there was still, you know, you could kind of do anything. You know, it was very experimental and it was great for somebody who didn't really know what they were doing yet. But there were very few people I had anything in common with because most of these, you know, there's a lot of jazz cats, you
right.
know, who are like really accomplished, but I did start a band, and then the band, you know, we played with other bands, so I started meeting other musicians and being part of that scene. Yeah, so I was a little bit more social, but I mean, you know, I was still, when I went to Berklee, I mean, it was fairly insular,
right?
You know, I had a couple of friends.
You know, I don't want to make this a whole "This Is Your Life" interview, but I do. I do think it's interesting to note that right kind of out of the gate, you had a really big hit record.
Yeah.
Not right out of the gate, but you know, you're very young. You have this big hit record, and I just wonder if that kind of set in your mind some expectation, or that there was some expectation from a record company standpoint that you had to meet, and it was really just like this. To me, you can't create that knowingly. That something weird has to happen, and things have to fall into place to have a hit record. But how did having one just like right off the bat kind of affect you going forward?
Well, you know, I mean, in retrospect, that seems crazy. But of course, when you're, you know, I was in this sort of punk band for, you know, for a couple of years, and then I got tired of that because I, you know, really like pop music more. You know, I mean, I like melodic stuff more. So I formed this other band, Till Tuesday, and, you know, we did an enormous amount of playing. Like, we rehearsed, like, we really, really, really worked hard. And we played, you know, an enormous amount of shows in, you know, New England, just driving around to, you know, up to New Hampshire and that kind of thing. And, you know, playing around Boston. And it didn't seem like that fast.
Right.
But, you know, like, I acknowledge that I think we got a record deal within 6 months of being together or something. Like, so, you know, but we really, really worked hard. And I think, you know, like, when back in those days, the measure, you know, like, your idea of success, like, what you're working for is this vague idea of, well, we'll get a record contract and then we will have made it. And you know, you don't understand or even hear about the gazillions of bands who get signed and then nothing happens. You kind of think if you get signed, that means something happens, is going to happen. So for us to have a hit with our first song was like, well, that isn't that what's supposed to, you know, like, that's kind of the thing. That's
right.
That's what we did. We were in this for. You know, I mean, now, like, obviously knowing what I know now, it seems like a miracle, but, you know, but we were playing we were right in the zeitgeist. Like, that's the, you know, that kind of dance pop stuff. We loved it, we played it, we wrote it, you know, we were four, like, you know, young, fairly good looking, teased hair, new wave creatures. You know, so, like, it's, like, I mean, we could tell that that was kind of like a thing that was coalescing. That, you know, like, we were right in the middle of our musical interests and our musical abilities coincided perfectly with exactly what was, you know, what was happening on the radio.
So did that become kind of an expectation for you that, oh, this is just what's going to happen every record?
I don't know. I did not have a great time with all of that. That came with so many weird responsibilities that were, I don't know, like, the responsibilities of the artist in a major label system are weird and unwritten. And I feel like I came up against these weird expectations of me that I obviously wasn't fulfilling, and I mean, like, I feel like people were really not happy. I wasn't, like, really happy with it. We were opening for Hall & Oates. Like, our first tour was opening for Hall & Oates, and they were playing arenas, and that was insane. And I was like, I just felt like I am not built for this. Like, I don't know. I don't have, because, like, I'm not one of those people, like, I've dreamed of being a star forever. Like, I, you know, I'm going to strut around the stage. That just wasn't my thing. And I felt like I was absolutely not up to that task. There's also, like, these other weird, like, visiting radio stations and glad-handing people and the schmoozing and making hundreds of phone calls to radio programmers and, like, that's not in my skill set. Well, yeah, so I felt like really, really wildly out of my depth.
You did?
Yeah.
And then, and it seems
it
like,
crazy.
you had to quickly, you know, at a very young age, like, have the, you know, the courage to say I'm out of my depth and to, like.
Which I didn't. I mean, I didn't. I mean, I. You know, also, like, the first single, because it was like one of those MTV video hits, we were really recognizable. And then having that attention, I found very disturbing, you know, because I don't like when people think the, like, oh, being famous will be fun. People will recognize me and I'll get lots of respect. But it's not like that. It's like, oh, I'll get followed home by weird guys. Like, that's nobody wants that. Like, nobody feels comfortable with that. Or I'll be eating at a restaurant and people will be watching me eat and I won't be sure why. Like, is it, because you can't get like, oh, obviously you're watching me because I'm famous. It's sometimes it might be you're staring at me because I just being stared at was weird. I mean, I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't feel comfortable with it at all.
Once you left the band and you did a solo record, you made a new record deal. Did you get a new record deal as a solo artist, or how did that work?
Well, Till Tuesday had made a third record, but the guitar player and the keyboard player had both left by that point. So the third record was like almost a bit of a solo record. There was a lot of changes at the label. They wanted Till Tuesday or me or whatever to be, you know, that was in the days of like this sort of reimaginings of like Heart and Cheap Trick, and you know, where like they write with those sort of same writers and it's the same kind of production and it's very like, you know, kind of the soft hair metal, you know
the
what
flame.
I mean? Yeah. It's, yeah.
Cheap
power,
shit, yeah.
Like power ballady.
Right.
And I was totally off. I was totally off that. Like I was off that pop. You know that sort of '80s pop sound. And I was, writing songs on acoustic guitar, and they were absolutely had no interest in that kind of thing, and. But they wouldn't let me out of my contract, so I was kind of languishing for 3 years before I think somebody else came into the company finally let me out of the contract. But the feeling was like, well, now we don't have to worry about her having a hit somewhere else. Like her career is obviously over, so we can let her go.
That's got to be so damaging to your psyche at that. Like
yeah.
when you're ready to go and. They won't let you work.
Yeah, I mean, they basically were, you know, I just released that third record, and they said, well, we don't know if we want to keep you on the label. And I was like, great, let me go. And they were like, no, because you might have a hit somewhere else. Like, they actually said that. And they were like, well, we just think you should, you know, just go in and make another record. I'm like, I released a record 3 months ago, like a month ago. Why don't you work this record? And, you know, I think what they just want, you know, they wanted me to be a thing that they could mold into their, you know, the flame thing.
Right.
And, you know, I just wasn't.
Well, I mean, I imagine it takes a great amount of like, you know, I don't want to say courage again, but to.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, because I can't do it. You know what I mean? Like that's the thing you do or that you can do if you're a performer who chiefly likes to perform in an arena setting and likes people to follow them home because you love the attention. Like that's for those people. And I'm the opposite of those people. I'm the person in the room, alone in the room writing, you know, and I can be on a stage, you know, with a small audience who's kind of like with me. But I can't, like, I'm not, you know, I'm not the performer in that way. I mean, it's, you know, for some people that works to have a team who's helping them write or just writing songs for them and producing and, like, you know, being this setting for the jewel that, you know, like the shiny jewel. But I'm, you know, like, I'm not that person.
So you eventually went, did a solo record. You did whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, major record. Very, from a critical standpoint, beautiful, amazing record. You worked with John Bryan but then you kind of experienced a similar thing with Imago, right? In terms of.
Eventually, you always get there. Yeah.
Eventually, like, with a major label,
we don't hear a hit. Yeah.
You end
yeah.
up in this limbo, right? So you kind of ended up on your second record again in limbo, where the record company wasn't pushing the record or wasn't promoting it, or
you know, I came in to Imago with a finished record, so it's like you did hear the record before you signed me, so I really don't want to hear this again. Like you heard the finished record, so you don't get to say that now. You don't get to like. Now try to manufacture and create some other singly sound after you've already heard what exactly. It's not like a vague idea of what I could do as an artist. You have the exact record before you said yes. That did drive me crazy.
I bet. At a record company, I know that there's the, you know, one person loves you and then that person moves to another job and the next person doesn't care. And
I think the Mago thing was that they were literally just like collapsing and going out of business and so they like merged into Geffen, or they gave me to Geffen. I think they sold or gave me to Geffen. So I wound up in Geffen. And then Geffen merged into Interscope with a bunch of other people. And then finally I think Interscope got inundated with so many artists from so many labels that they were more amenable to the idea of just releasing people from their contracts. And I was like, yes, please, please let me go. I think they'll think people still have had this idea of like, well, we can make you a star, you know, like, and I'm like, I don't want that. Like, I want to make good records. Like, that's not even my thing. So if I can't make the record, if I can't make a record I'm proud of, then I don't care. I don't want to be a star on some other weird terms.
So tell me about the time when you had this, I mean, I'm romanticizing it or imagining it, but did you have this moment when you said, I can just have my own label, I can just put my own music out?
Yeah, I mean, that was when Geffen went to Interscope, and then we had meetings with like Jimmy Iovine, and once again, I had a finished record. Record was totally done. And he goes, well, it's not finished till I say it's finished. but they did say, they did tell us, if you want to go, if you want to be released, we'll release you. And I'm like, I cannot get out of here fast enough. Because I could not imagine going through the same thing. You know, where once again, I have a finished record, you've heard the record, and yet you don't think there's a single, of course. Also, like their idea of success, like what was a successful record, you know, there was a conversation going on in the room, kind of separate chit-chat conversation about what a disappointment Sheryl Crow's last 1.5 million selling record was. And I'm like, what? You know, just like looking around for the hidden camera.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, no, that was a terrible disappointment that to only sell 1.5 million records. So
right.
It was just madness. I was like, I can't imagine opting for this situation again. And I really was like, I don't even care. I sell records out of the back of a van, I don't care. And, you know, selling records on the internet was just a thing that you could just sort of do, barely, you know, sort of mail order kind of do. And I didn't really know what the implications were, if it was I was just like, I don't care. I can't do this anymore.
Well,
because
it
wasn't like I was making any money. You know what I mean? It's not like, oh, I'm leaving my great salaried position, or like they're giving me money, or they give me such big advances that I have money to live on. I mean, you know, the advances were enough to make a record that then they would do nothing with, and I wouldn't make any money. You know, I didn't make any money touring. Tours are always break even. So why? You know, the only reason to do it is to do because you then can make records you're proud of. And if that was going to be a giant struggle, like, what's the point with the idea that Jimmy Iovine might make me a star? Really?
Well,
after Sheryl Crow has been such a disappointment.
Yeah, 1.5 million records. We wouldn't want to disappoint Jimmy. But I think that, you know, when you did that, it was still, I mean, now, of course, it's very commonplace for a band to figure out how to do their own thing, but you were really one of the first artists to do that and say, you know, to the point where it really became kind of music news that you just went off, you're going to start your own label, you're going to do this thing yourself. Was there ever a point when you were like, oh God, what, like, I have to learn how to do this? Or was there ever a point where you're like, I didn't know how much work this was? Or was it all kind of like fun and discovery?
Well, it was me and my manager. And my manager, you know, this is where he lives. Like the idea of figuring out the kind of business model and how to make that happen. And, you know, that was his thing. Like, you know, my thing was still making records. You know, it wasn't that I didn't suddenly have to start, you know, figuring out how to be a businessman. Like, you know, so he was my partner in this. And I remember asking him one time, you know, not so long after that, like, well, what is your, you know, is it easier or is it harder? Like, what is your life, you know, like, what is your job like? And he's like, well, before, my days were spent trying to figure out how to get people at the record label to do their job. And that was, all my energy was spent on that. And now all my energy is just spent on, you know, promoting the record, marketing the record, and all this energy was like actually had a measurable result. It wasn't trying to like manipulate other people to like do what they're supposed to do.
Right.
So, you know, I think it worked out for both of us.
I mean, in some ways, did you have to figure it out along the way, and now it's kind of, the system's kind of in place?
No, because I think the system is always changing. I think initially it was easier because we just applied, you know, some basic logic of how, look, selling a record was not rocket science. You know, like, you know, you do some touring, you get some press, you do some marketing. You know, we couldn't really afford to make a video, and that was still the MTV days, so that was out anyway. But I wasn't making videos on the major label, so it's, you know, or maybe one or two, but you know, that wasn't really part of our thing. MTV was never going to play a video by us anyway. So, you know, when you get your record in the stores, and we were able to sign a distribution deal, which was like the real lucky thing that I formed my own label and was able to sign a distribution deal. So, you know, so we got records in the stores. But now there are no stores and there are no records. So it's a totally different thing. And it's, now it's more difficult because things are changing so rapidly and people aren't paying money for music.
Right.
So, you know, it's a giant question mark. But when we were first starting, like the first 5 years, like that was, like we had, you know, a 5-year period where things were really, really great because, you know, all our effort was put into, you know, when a record was sold, we would get the money, you know?
Right.
We actually made money selling a thing that we made. That was kind of great. We had like a tiny little golden era.
I agree with you that things are changing so fast now that it almost is like you don't know where the next cut is going to come from.
Yeah.
Now it's subscription services where you get like 0.001.
Well, that's useless.
Percent of a penny.
I mean, that doesn't even. Yeah, that's useless. That's not even. That's not.
So how do you go forward? I mean, I know that you're. You definitely, you know, you do some social media, and I know you're on Twitter, and I wonder if you find that an enjoyable thing or if that's like part of the necessary thing you have to do as an artist now to stay in touch with people who are listening to your music.
Well, something like Twitter was, I think initially, you know, probably was my manager saying like, you should be on Twitter, and me feeling reluctant about doing it. Now I find it fun because it's just so dopey, you know, like just posting dopey things. And most of the people I follow are comedian friends or, you know, sort of musicians who are, you know, comedy hybrids and just kind of dicking around back and forth with my friends. So like to me it's more it becomes more of a social thing. It's like, you know, the like a little 10-minute party where, you know, you chat with a couple of people on some ridiculous dumb riff and
right.
Then, you know.
No, I do find it interesting though that like it's the medium made for comedians. Like as everyone
Absolutely.
Else is kind of crashing
it's joke
and
writing.
Burning.
Yeah, it's joke writing. Yeah.
It's joke writing and it's like having a platform. I think that's fascinating and liberating. But for a musician, for someone who's writing songs and makes their living, having people either pay to hear these songs or pay to hear you play, it is scary now, like how that future looks. I mean, do you have to kind of resolve yourself to, you make the record, you give it away, and hopefully people will come see you live and that's your income?
I don't make money playing live.
Now tell me about that.
Well, It costs money to pay musicians, to have a crew, to have a bus, to pay for hotel rooms. You know, this tour I'm taking out, I have a full band because I have, you know, a new record and I want to replicate the sound of the record. And you know, if you have a record that has keyboards and electric guitar and bass and drum, you know, like to go out and just introduce those songs on acoustic guitar is kind of, doesn't make any sense.
Sure.
So, but it's a break-even situation. And it always has been. You know, like none of those tours I did back in the 90s or whatever ever made money. Like I never, which is part of the problem, by the way, of feeling good about going on tour and being hounded by the record company to like stay on tour and go on tour. And you're like, I'm killing myself out here and I'm making zero money. You know, if I do a smaller tour, an acoustic tour, and that's how I've been touring mostly, I can make a little bit of money, which is, you know, refreshing for me, you know, for me to like, I mean, I have to say to, you know, if your manager says like, you know, like they really want you to fly in and do this, you know, like a show in Denver or whatever, but you'll be in, you know, or whatever, wherever it is, and you're totally exhausted, to be told, you know, you'll make $1,000, you know, okay, that, you know, but I mean, every other time, like through my entire lifetime, it's been, you're just going to, it's just work for nothing. You know, like what, and like, once again, like, what is it, work for this, the dream of that I'll be a star? But I think that like works on a lot of people. Like, I think, I mean, it must, because, you know, I mean, unless you're sleeping five in a van, there's, you know, people aren't, you can't make any money.
Right.
And I like to pay my people. I mean, I know you know,
sure,
know some of the musicians I work with. Like I'm not gonna ask people to go on the road for like $500 a week or something, or, you know, make them sleep four to a room, or, you know, like these are grown up professional musicians who deserve to be paid.
And
like, they're not making that much.
The amount of talent they have, like, you wanna pay them and you wanna make them comfortable. And I guess going forward, it seems like maybe the biggest income streams for songwriters are film and TV placements.
And that's going down too, because I think there's kind of this global perception as people get used to, you know, people now believe that music has no value because it's so easy to download music for free. And there's so many musicians and artists and bands and, you know, that there's like a huge glut of it. So, you know, there's a huge supply and no demand. And so, you know, music supervisors and movies and TV now, I think are influenced by that same thing and think we don't have to pay that much. And like, we can get music for, you know, for cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And there's also like more competition for for those slots. So, you know, that's drying up too.
It's funny because, you know, you talked earlier about you know, feeling like you get better at your craft with every record and the more you go on. And yet from a purely business standpoint, and I'm assuming you'd write a song whether or not anyone ever heard it, because you say you enjoy doing it, but from a business standpoint, it does. You look at the future and it's like, how can I sustain doing this, you know, and what will be, you know, because I'm sure that at some point iTunes and people buying, you know, anyone left buying iTunes will run out, just like anyone left buying CDs has basically run out. So, you know, I guess it's just, I wonder where your head is on that. Like, do you ever just stop and go, why am I doing this?
Well, before this last record, and that's probably why it took me so long to put out the record. It was really, you know, when people don't buy music, it's hard to not feel that they don't want music. And if people don't want music, it's hard to feel like there's a reason to go to the trouble of making a record and paying for it yourself, which, you know, I mean, that's like $120,000 of my own money that I'm paying to make a record. And then you go like, why? I can't have it be a vanity project where I literally go into the hole to make a record for what? To show off? You know, to go like, look at me, I'm a musician. I don't even, like, it was really hard to figure out why. And I think that my attitude has to be, I mean, actually similar to when I was 18 years old. Like, I'm just, as long as there's a next step, I'll take the next step. And at the point where there's not a next step, I'll consider other options. And if the step starts to be, you know, where I'm not selling enough records to pay to make the cost of making a record, I'll make cheaper records. And, you know, and that's going to be, I mean, you're going to see a lot of either really super produced Taylor Swifty, Beyonce kind of really, really commercial stuff that is financed by record companies because they have other things. You know what I mean? Like Taylor Swift is like selling perfumes and stuff. You know, like there are a lot of other, it's like a, you know, like a franchise kind of thing. Those are going to be big, very, very commercial records, or kind of laptop-y, very sterile records, or a lot of acoustic guitar, you know, and that's, you know, probably my next record will be, I mean, that mostly because I'm in the mood for it, but that probably will be all I can afford to do is like an acoustic guitar in a room.
That's amazing, and I can't help but like put that up against the idea that a couple years ago you got invited to the White House to perform as part of their, you know, poetry series. And I wonder if it brings up the topic for me, like, are we creating a situation where we're either going to need patrons for the arts again?
Or I think we are. I think we are, probably. Like, that probably is what's going to happen. It'll be like, you know, like the Kings that like
Eli Broad
sponsored Mozart and got him to write, you know, like, well, I'll commission some work from you. Yeah.
And I wonder if artists will be able to develop, or like, I wonder if we're going to lose something in that transition to where everyone expects their entertainment for free.
Absolutely. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure of it. You know, there's, I think you're going to get a lot of people who still believe in that rock star, like, I want to be a rock star thing. Those people are very tiresome because they're just, you know, it's that's all about just wanting the attention.
Right.
I think artists who are more insular and need time and space to develop over a period of time, playing lots of shows, you know, being on tour over a long period of time. If there's no kind of just like working class level that you can, you know, support yourself at, they can't do it.
Right, right. So I heard that you're doing a film based on This American Life episode.
Yeah, and the movie's called Pleased to Meet Me.
But what I found interesting is that there's been a musician hired for every role in the film. So it's, rather than finding a bunch of actors and having them pretend to be musicians, it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's all musicians.
Yeah, and I wonder,
and I'm not even playing a musician.
You're not playing a musician. Okay.
And Joe Henry's in it. He's playing an engineer. John Doe's in it. Loudon Wainwright's in it. Karen Berquist from Over the Rhine is in it. And then we did in Louisville and a bunch of local musicians. Oh, yeah. It's fun. I mean, it's a real, like, I think they did sort of a Kickstarter thing. So the impression I get is it's pretty...
It's low budget.
It's pretty low budget. So, like, I don't even know if it's going to come out or not, but it was really fun.
Now, you've been intertwined with acting and actors and stuff through the Coen brothers and your experience with Magnolia and everything. And I just wonder if you, on the set, watching these musicians, do you think they pulled it off as actors?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think everybody was really good.
Were you out of your comfort zone? Because that's, I mean, you've been in films, but this is a much bigger role.
Yeah.
For you, right?
Yeah, no, I was completely out of my comfort zone. I mean, having said that, it's not like there was a lot of emotional highs or lows that I had to hit. So I just had to more or less appear to be an actual natural seeming person. I think also because it was so low budget, there was so little time, you really just had to go like, all right, here we go. Like, here we go. And I couldn't really, I didn't have any time to be self-conscious about it.
Right.
Because here we go. We have 5 minutes. Let's get the shot and move on.
It's not like it's take 30.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring the hair and makeup in again.
Yeah. We just had to leap in.
Right. And, did that spark anything? Like, I always wondered, especially after Magnolia, because from the way I understood that, those songs were written and Paul fit them into the film. He didn't ask you to write those songs for the film. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's more or less right. Although there was some, like, as he was writing, like, we were both sort of writing our respective projects at the same time. So there was, like, intertwining and conversations about, you know. There were other songs I wrote that were specifically for, or that, like, inspired by scenes in movies. Like, I don't even think I'm good at like writing a song for a scene, but then I'll see something and then I'll get an idea and then, you know, but like wherever it goes, it goes. So there were other songs, but that just didn't like kind of happen for the movie.
I wondered if it ever gave you, you know, if you ever had any desire to maybe direct or to write a film or to, you know, to take it that one step further where you're in control of the whole thing.
No. Nope, not at all. I you know, once again, writing and screenplays, like that's a whole structure that I think, you know, people really have to, you really have to like live your entire life within a certain structure to master it, I think. You know, like playwriting or screenplay writing, like there are internal rules of logic that, you know, why certain things work the way they do. And mastering a form just takes a lifetime to, you know, like, for me anyway, like, I have to internalize the form so that it's invisible, and then whatever I do kind of gets input into that form. So, you know, I'm just like, I'm happy with a 3-minute, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, bridge, outro, third, yeah, like, you know, yeah, I really like that form, and there's a couple of variations, you know, that within that form, but I like internalizing the structure because it makes me feel like I'm more creative. I think most people are more creative if they have a really rigid structure that you need a skeleton to put flesh on.
I totally agree with that. I think the scariest thing is when someone approaches you and says, you can do anything.
Yeah, and then you're dealing with like a big, disgusting, boneless blob.
Exactly. Well, you know, I just wondered, is there like an artistic pursuit that you wish you could do or that?
Well, I wish I could write prose. I mean, I wish I, you know, yeah, I think I wish I could write stories or something, but.
Are you a big reader?
Yeah, but I don't think I can.
I think that mystery of how other people do their craft is so fascinating because if you can do it, maybe it doesn't seem magical for you. And then to people who can't do it,
yeah,
you know, it just,
yeah. I mean, to me, a pop song structure just seems so easy and so right there. You know, the structure of a play, the structure of a screenplay, the structure of a novel. I can't even imagine. That does seem like. You gotta be some crazy genius to like,
right,
you know, from chapter to chapter kind of structure a story, and it's amazing.
So you've always, for a long time at least, connected yourself with comedians, and I remember an early show at Largo that I saw where Patton Oswalt was doing your between song banter.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is a good way. Amy obviously likes to make a joke out of her, you know, her lack of joy in speaking to the audience. And so, and I thought it was this really genius idea, but as it turns out, that was just kind of the beginning of this association you've had with comedians. Yeah. How did that all start?
Well, that was the first thing. Like Michael Penn, my husband Michael Penn, and I had played a show at Largo, and you know, in the post show deconstruction, it's always the same thing. You know, like maybe the show went well, maybe the show didn't go well, but the thing we always lament about the most was, I didn't know what to say between songs. You know, like I don't know what to say between songs. I don't know what to say to the audience. It's also compounded by the fact that for me, the headspace of getting inside the song is not, it uses a different part of the brain than talking. And I can't switch back, I couldn't switch back and forth between them, even if I was good at the talking part. But, you know, so it's like one or the other suffers. And so we were having this conversation, and then I was like, well, we know all these comedians, like we should, you know, like my first idea was, let's get comics to like write banter on just like on index cards, and like we'll just, you know, randomly pick an index card, you know, like, thank you, that song was written in a state of despair, you know, like whatever. And then you know, we thought like, well, let's just get like actually get the guy, you know, the guy on, like the pinch hitter. We'll just drop back and he'll come on. We did a whole tour with touring with comedians. Yeah, Patton did a bunch of shows. David Cross did some. Paul F. Tompkins did a lot. Andy Kindler did a bunch. Todd Barry did some. Yeah, we did that was like a whole tour.
And you seem very fine with laughing at your difficulties in that area.
Yeah.
Like you don't see, it doesn't seem to bother you, because there were shows I saw where they were really kind of taking the piss out of you, so to speak.
No, I mean, like, as long as they're funny, you know.
Right.
I think the only person who gets, the only person who, like, skirts a weird edge is David Cross, because he's just, like, such an edgy, angry dude. You know, like, every now and then he would say something, he'd go like, oh, that's a... That's a little, that's maybe a little too much. But, you know, everybody else was their friends, you know, so.
Did you learn from them and then take what they did?
Yeah.
Like, on subsequent tours, you can do a little more?
Well, sometimes, literally, there was a joke that Patton made that I just had to repeat almost every time for, like, a couple of years, before Save Me, he said his banter was, you know, this is a song that I lost an Oscar to Phil Collins in his cartoon Monkey Love song. And so so I had to repeat, I repeated that for a while, like I just, you know.
Right.
Because I just thought it was such a great joke. But yeah, I think being around these guys and seeing how their minds work, you pick up, I mean, I felt like just through osmosis a little bit, I've kind of picked up, I think, just like I can kind of adopt a little of their, you know, their vibe. Like, there's sort of, you know, like Patton has this really relaxed kind of thing. I don't know, it just helps. You know what, I think it like helps to be around, it helps to be around people whose minds work in a way that you aspire to, and it's like their brain helps to regulate your own brain, and it's, you know, out of its dysfunction.
Right, right.
I'm actually like really a believer in that. Like, I do think that there's something that happens when you're around people whose minds work in a different way, and, you know, I mean, if you're lucky, you know, it's a positive thing. I mean, I think that's why 12-step stuff works, because you're around people whose minds are working, you know, similar to yours, but in recovery, and you kind of adopt it or get it. I like, it helps to regulate your own brain, like your own thinking.
Being a songwriter and doing these cycles, right? You make a record, you tour for a while, you kind of decompress from that, and then at some point you make another record and you tour. Are there things you do that that fulfill you in different ways, in terms of like that kind of thing, like trying to better yourself in another area? Or
yeah, I mean, I kind of bounce from thing to thing, and whatever the thing is, I'll just do it for a while because it's fun. You know, I go through phases where I like to paint. In the last year, off and on, I started taking lessons from a German tutor because I wanted to learn how to speak German. I took it a little bit in school, and I thought, you know, obviously, there's not really a reason for me to learn another language. You know, I'm about to go to Europe and play 3 shows in Germany, but like that's not sort of like a reason to learn how to speak German. You know, I just thought, I've always wanted to learn how to speak German, and I am over 50 years old. When is that going to happen? When I'm 70? Like, I'm going to, you know, like, do a thing if you always wanted to do a thing. Like, let's do it. Do
That's
it now.
Pretty commendable. I mean, I think that you get older and it's much harder, like, especially with language, too.
Yeah.
The memorization thing goes way down, and the ability to, like, you know, handle whole pieces of information.
Oh, yeah. And I have a terrible memory. Like, it's not like I'm really learning. Like, it's not like I'm really speaking it or learning it that well. But I like to learn things, and, you know, if you work with a tutor, I mean, you're going to come out of it knowing more than you did. I mean, maybe it's not that much, but, you know, I don't know. I just feel, it feels like it's good for you. It's good for you to try to do things that you can't already do. You know, it's got to be good for you.
And what do you paint?
Oh, I went to this thing where I painted the 10 worst presidents. I just wanted to, like, I don't know why. I actually do know why. It started because I have a friend who works in the White House, and he had gotten a new office, and I went to visit him, and he had, like, this giant blank wall, and I'm like, dude, you really need some artwork for your office, you know, I'll paint you a picture, and he's like, oh, yeah, paint me a picture of Millard Fillmore, And so I was like, I decided to do that. And then that kind of morphed into, I'm going to paint all the really bad presidents.
And what was the criteria for the top 10?
Oh, I actually found a list. It was like a U.S. News and World Report, the top 10 worst presidents.
Really?
Yeah.
And who's number one?
Oh, I can't remember. Who is number one? Because there's some bad ones. I think Andrew Jackson was not considered to be so great.
Really? And yet he's on the $20 bill.
Millard Fillmore, Coolidge, Grant, Hoover. That's my best painting is Hoover. William Henry Harrison, who lasted 30 days because he made such a long speech at his inaugural address in the cold that he got pneumonia and died.
See, I didn't
know
this.
I'm terrible laughing at this.
That's actually how he died. He was too verbose.
Yes, that's right. He made a 3-hour speech in the cold.
See, this should be a warning for everyone who speaks publicly. Although now we have antibiotics, so people can really...
Yeah.
Now, I'm fascinated by that you decided not only to give this man some artwork for his new office in the White House.
Which I never did, by the way. Like, it's all on my wall. Like, I never said...
Oh, you never gave it to him,
I never even gave it to him, yeah. Because he decided... Well, he was then got superstitious, and he was like, well, I don't want the 3 worst presidents. Like, can you... You know, would you paint a picture of my... You know, like, Joe and Obama, which I want to do, but the thing is, like, I'm not that great. Like, a couple of the paintings I think are really good. Like, Hoover's great. William Henry Harrison is great, and Grant, like, those are the 3 best ones, but the other ones are not, like, really terrific. So, and then you don't want to paint a picture of somebody you like and have it, like, not really look like them.
So, you know, how does this happen? Like, do you guys have, you share, obviously, your husband is Michael Penn, you guys live together, you're both musicians.
Yeah.
Like, is it just an art commune over there? Are you painting and he's playing guitar? I mean,
well, he does a lot of recording there, so he kind of takes over a lot of the common spaces. My brother refers to the living room as Czechoslovakia, and there's like a sort of little library that he refers to as Poland. He says, he's already taken over Czechoslovakia. Don't let him get Poland. So there's like a lot of equipment and junk and, you know, and then I paint in the kitchen. So all the presidents are up in the kitchen. It's like a little, it's a little hoardy, like it's a little bit cluttery and hoardy. And then we've both gone through these phases of, you know, the collect, you know, the Rose Bowl collecting fevers,
sure.
You know, so that, so you see these patches of collections of stuff. Like he was really into, you know, Knights Templar and Masonic stuff. So there's swords and Masonic aprons and plumed hats, you know, like Knights Templar hats and just, you know, crazy stuff. Where I have African masks and stuffed Santas.
Yeah, Santas.
You remember the stuffed Santas.
I photographed you with the Santas. And I always wondered if you guys ever talked about making a record together. I mean, I know you've toured together, but did you ever?
Just like, you know, every now and then we'll do a song. Yeah, but we're not good. When we first got together, we tried to collaborate on songwriting, and it doesn't, we both have the same kind of like, we're both like finishers, like we're not great starters. You know, like with John Brine, it was a good collaboration because he generated a lot of ideas that he could never finish. And I'm a good finisher, you know. Like I could always hear a thing of, you know, initial idea of John's to go, I know exactly where it should go. But I think Michael and I have that same, you know, so nobody's starting us, like nobody starts it.
As a partnership, if no one starts it, you just
and then somebody
sit there.
Has to take ownership of the song. You know, like you have to say, like, okay, here's a chunk, take it, do with it whatever you want. Neither of us, like, we're both reluctant to give up control of the song.
Would that lead to marital spats?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, we'd probably scrap about it.
I mean, I wonder. You know, I am married to someone who does something completely different than I do,
mm-hmm.
and I know the easy answer is, well, there's advantages and disadvantages to having a spouse that does the same thing you do. But I wonder more specifically if you find it, you know, how you find that. If you find it easier, or harder, or more interesting.
I liked it. I like it, yeah. I like it. I mean, I, you know, because he, you know, it's like we do the same thing, so he understands, you know, the struggles of it. I mean, now he's expanded his work into, he does a lot of scoring now. You know, because Michael actually has a lot more abilities than, I mean, I write songs and that's it. You know, that's my thing. I make records, but I don't produce, you know. And he's a producer and he can score and, you know, he's very facile in a lot of aspects. But, you know, playing live and touring was never his thing. He's great live. He just he's very uncomfortable with it, I think. And he never liked touring. And, you know, touring is very stressful, but I like it now mostly because of the people I play with. You know, I have a band that I really, and specific players, like it's my bass player, Paul Bryan, who produces my records now. And, you know, I think just working with him has really helped me enjoy playing live, because it's just you know, it's sort of like that one brain learns from another brain. He just has a way of being very emotionally connected to music in a live situation, which has helped me connect to him and to the other musicians and to the audience. And I think my experience playing live has really, really changed since working with him.
Would you say that you enjoy it a lot more now?
Oh, yeah, way more.
And was,
I mean, I wouldn't even have said that I enjoyed it before. It was just because it was so many, like, it came along with so many other anxieties. So it was hard to, like, really enjoy it.
It's less of a struggle just because you know yourself more.
Yeah. It's also less of a struggle because I'm not working for the man. You know, like, you know, before tours were something that you were really prodded to do, you know, past your ability. By a record company. And, you know, so just working for myself, I can go, you know, like I go out for 3 weeks or 4 weeks at a time, which is the most I can really handle because it is it's physically stressful. And when I came back from this last tour, like I immediately got sick and, you know, was kind of like incapacitated for almost this last month. So, I mean, obviously it's even more physically stressful than I'm aware of at the time. And, you know, I just have to go like, keep that in mind, that will probably happen. You know, it doesn't seem like it should, but it does. So, you know, knowing that you can set your own schedule and plan for that and work around it is really helpful, you know, that there's not this other entity that's kind of flogging you and
right.
threatening you sort of into working, you know, because that happened. I mean, I remember being in Imago and being, you know, really, really pressured to stay on the road and you know, do extra touring. And I really had like a physical breakdown because I, you know, like just this totally exhausted, you know, kind of adrenal exhaustion thing where I couldn't get out of bed. So, you know, it's nice to be able to take care of yourself and not have to, you know, fight with these other outside influences.
I think one of the things that has been such a positive about the kind of deconstruction of the music industry is that people can put more of it in their own hands and
yeah.
decide what to do. And
yeah.
And they're not, yeah, you're working for yourself.
Yeah.
And so you want to be out there more because you have more of a relationship to the profit that
yeah.
comes from that. But also, yeah, you're not, someone isn't telling you to do it and someone isn't telling you to do something that doesn't feel right to you.
And then you get stuck in a real us against them, you know. And then it's very hard for your mindset to not be, people are making me do stuff, because they kind of are, you know. They're making me do stuff that I don't even make money, you know, like I'm not even getting paid to do it. But there's this enormous pressure and nobody, I think, like, there's not a human being on the earth that needs to have more time spent, you know, in a victimized mindset, you know. It's hard enough to not feel like, you know, you're beleaguered by, you know, the fates or the events of, you know, technology is, you know, like ruining my life or whatever it is, or just, you know.
I have too many emails.
Yeah, the fates conspiring, like, how can he ask me to do this? Doesn't he know how busy I am or whatever? Like, I think, like, everybody I know struggles not feeling like a victim in some way. So, you know, boy, like, that didn't help. You know, so it's nice to feel like, no, I am making my own choice. These are my decisions. I'm out here of my own volition. Yes, it's very difficult, you know, but I've chosen it.
You know, I could do this all day. You're such an easy person to talk to and this has been really fun, and it just seems like, you know, you're in a great place, and it's all deserved. And
thank you so much, Sam.
Yeah, this has been so great to.
I feel good about, you know. I mean, there's like things are changing, but I feel like that can't be a bad thing. It's got to be good.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And maybe it won't be like 12 years till we see each other again.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.